and you're listening to The Record on KUOW. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jeannie Yandel. You've probably seen it by now, that video of airport security dragging a passenger off a United Express flight over the weekend. United had to make room for four crew members on a sold-out flight. They asked for volunteers, and then...
Come on. Gotta go.
Oh, this is
busted
cold.
His lip.
Oh, my God! Look at what you did to him!
The CEO of United has defended his staff, and travel writer Harriet Baskis said she was alarmed when she watched that video, but she wasn't exactly surprised.
I've been on planes where people have been taken off planes for all sorts of reasons. I've never seen a big fight like this, but that's what they do, and the airlines have a right to have someone taken off a plane. As it came out that it was, at first we heard that it was because a flight was overbooked, but it really wasn't overbooked. They were just trying to make room for crew members. So I was a little alarmed, but not surprised.
You were a little alarmed, but not surprised. I have to ask, what legal rights do you have once you buy an airline ticket?
So I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know all the rules, and I haven't read that contract, all those contracts of carriage that come with our ticket, that used to be the paper part that we used to get and now is online. And different airlines, I think, have some different rules. But if they cancel a flight, as long as they get you where you said you were going to go, often they don't have to compensate you. If they overbook and take you off a flight involuntarily, there are some compensation rules, and sometimes they seem pretty generous. But yeah, the rules are kind of mushy and in favor of the airlines.
Is it even legal for airlines to take a seat from you that you've already paid for?
Yes. And I think that's what a lot of us are learning. We don't, when we buy a ticket on an airplane, we're not really buying a seat or that seat on that flight. We're buying really a ticket from here to there, and the airlines actually can have a lot of rights to change your plans. When we buy a ticket on an airplane, we're not really buying a seat or that seat on that flight. We're buying really a ticket from here to there, and the airlines actually can have a lot of rights to change your plans.
That inspires a little bit of dread in my stomach that I don't have a lot of control over my own schedule when I buy an airplane ticket. But I do know that each passenger on that United Express flight was offered up to $1,000 in compensation, which usually looks like flight vouchers or free tickets, something like that. They were also offered spots on the next flight out the next day. I do wonder why airlines can't offer more than that. I mean, $1,000 in flight vouchers and a spot on the next flight the next day, that really wouldn't compel me to stand up either, to be honest. I have work, I have a child, there's a lot of other things I have to think about.
Right. I mean, for some people who don't have to, who are more flexible, that, I mean, obviously the people who took it, it was fine. I think that airline or airlines have an upper limit of how much they can offer, and I've been reading that they could have gone up to $1,300, but for some reason didn't. I don't know if an extra $300 would have made a difference to those people. Again, it was the last flight of the weekend. It was a small plane. All those people would have had to stay over and miss whatever they had to do the next day. So, yeah, they could have gone higher. I've been I've been next to a gate where I wished I was on the flight, because they were offering $1,000 and like $300 in Amazon gift cards. That was the first time I had heard that, and I thought I would do it.
But you wrote a book called Stuck at the Airport. You like spending time in airports.
That's right. And usually I schedule my time so that I can spend more time at the airport. As much as possible, I try not to make a flight schedule that's so tight that if something goes wrong, or if there's weather or a maintenance delay, that it's not going to ruin my plans. And if there's an offer to get bumped, I'm usually the first one up there.
Well, one of the things that happened after the fallout from this story was the CEO of United wrote a public letter, and one of the last lines of the letter was that he thinks United can learn from this. They can learn from this experience. And the thing that he thinks United employees can learn is, quote, We need to treat our customers and each other with respect and dignity. That's the core of who we are. You're laughing as I say that. Why are you laughing?
Well, to his credit, he's said that before, and that airline has, up until now, seemingly been working pretty hard to repair relationships with passengers, passengers in the global sense, that it's needed to do some relationship repair in the past. So they have been, that's been a line he's used before. In this case, there's a lot to learn. Clearly, there's, and again, there's still details we don't know, but there is a lot to learn. And, you know, there's everything from dealing with customers at the gate to how a company deals with a disaster like this, because people were pointing out that it took hours, and they still haven't really talked to the public to tell people what had happened and to apologize or do something else.
Well, there may be some lessons for United here, but what do you think airline passengers should learn from this? I have a ticket. I'm supposed to fly somewhere in June. What should I learn? What's the lesson I should learn from this?
So the lesson you should learn from this is leave wiggle room in your schedule if possible. Don't take the last flight of the weekend on a Sunday night on a small airline to a place where there might be thunderstorms in the summer. So try to leave wiggle room in your schedule. If you can, don't fly those smaller airlines that overbook more so than the larger airlines. And I think it's JetBlue that has a policy of not even overbooking. You want to check in really early for your flight. Sometimes when airlines are overbooked and they have to start bumping people, they'll start bumping from the, you know, last arrived will be the first person bumped. So you can check in 24 hours before your flight. Do that as soon as possible. There's these new basic economy fares that have come out that seem like a good deal, and you don't get your seat assignment until the last minute, till you show up at the airport sometimes. But again, if you don't have a seat, it's kind of like musical chairs. If you're the last one left who doesn't have a seat, you might be the first one to get bumped. And if you're on a plane and an airline crew member asks you to get up and move or leave, you need to cooperate, because in this post 9/11 world, the federal laws are in favor of the airlines.
It also sounds like I should read the carriage contract rather than just clicking, I have read and accepted the terms of this ticket.
Yeah, it's probably incomprehensible, but it can't hurt.
Harriet Baskis blogs at Stuck at the Airport, and she writes about air travel and airlines for USA Today and NBC News. This is The Record. More in a minute. It's KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel, in for Bill Radke. And if you're struggling right now to finish your taxes, just know that President Trump is right there with you. After finding out that health care reform is, as he said, more complicated than anyone knew, now he's hoping to overhaul the American tax system, a gargantuan Byzantine system that our next guest calls a fine mess. That's the name of the new book by T.R. Reid, the former Washington Post correspondent. He looks at how other countries do their tax collection to see what we can learn. Here's T.R. Reid with Bill Radke.
Do people in other countries agonize over their returns every year, or else hire expensive accountants to figure it out?
No, they can't figure out why we would want to do that. You can walk down the street in Amsterdam, London, Lima, Tokyo, and you'll never see an H&R Block because other countries don't need that service. In the Netherlands, for example, average time to file your state and federal tax return, 15 minutes. In Japan, almost nobody has to file a return. You got a postcard from the government in March. It says, we think you earned this much, we withheld that much, we owe you a refund of this much, we'll put it in your bank on April 1st. You don't even have to file a return. Nobody else has made it as hard as we have.
Have they found out about all the exemptions and deductions we have?
Some of them used to have those. And, you know, if you get rid of those exemptions and deductions, you get two things. You get, first, you can lower the tax rate because you're taxing a bigger base. But second, it just makes things easier. You don't need 20 forms. It doesn't take hours. You don't have to pay somebody hundreds of dollars to do your tax return. So they found it simpler. And when it's simpler and when the rates are lower, then you get a higher rate of compliance. If people think, oh my God, those rich people, they have 100 write-offs, they're not paying anything, then I'm not inclined to pay either. If you think everybody's paying at a decent rate, well, then people are more likely to comply. So the complexity of our code is a ridiculous problem. And guess what? Here's the bad news. The IRS could fill in every line on the return for about 80% of American families. I don't know if you've ever gotten this. You get a letter from the IRS. It's called a CP2000 notice. They send out millions of them a year. And this is the one that says, on line 48Q, you entered $4,213, but actually, it's $4,711.
If you know that, why am I doing the return?
Exactly. That's what I get these every year, and I think, why did I spend hours trying to put the wrong number on the right line or something when they could do it? And several members of Congress have said, hey, yeah, let's do that. Let's have the IRS do the work for us. And when that's proposed in Congress, guess what? H&R Block lobbies against it.
As I was saying, we have all these deductions and exemptions, and we complain about them, but of course, somebody loves them. A lot of people love the mortgage deduction and the charitable deduction. Do voters in the Netherlands and wherever, do they have no problem choosing what they want to do to make their tax bill go down or to do something they really want to do?
No, this is a really good point. Everybody loves the particular deduction that they get, and therefore it's hard to take it away. And what's happened is these other countries have found politically you can take it away, you can eliminate those deductions. And there are two ways to do this. First, you have to do it big. You can't do one at a time because that will just tick off one group. You eliminate all the deductions and exemptions, and that lets you lower the rates sharply. And so when people complain, oh my God, I'm losing that deduction, you say, yeah, but you're going to get lower rates and it's going to be much easier to file. And if you can give that trade-off, other countries have found that it works. Many countries have eliminated the charitable deduction. Most countries have eliminated the mortgage interest deduction, even though they're very popular, because you say to people, you get a lower rate, you get an easier return, and people accept that trade-off.
Well, you make it sound like a simple grand bargain, but you and I are old enough both to remember the flat tax, the tax return you could fill out on a postcard, or was it a post-it note? I mean, I come to assume that's impossible here.
No, it's not. It could be done. I mean, you look at, there are hundreds and hundreds of exemptions. Just in the personal income tax, there are more than 200 different credits and deductions. You get a credit in America for taking a night school course, growing sugarcane, replanting a forest, insulating the attic, destroying old farm equipment, employing Native Americans, commuting to work by bicycle. Get this, you get a tax credit, $7,500, if you buy a $105,000 Tesla sports car. Now, why do we need that?
Right, because it's a hybrid or it's electric.
Yeah, that's right. And so the argument is, well, that's good because it reduces the use of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Then why do we give a tax credit for recreational vehicles, which use a lot of gas? I mean, the thing just doesn't make sense. And what we found in other countries is if you do it big, if you take away all of them at once and then lower the rates, people will accept that deal.
T.R. Reid, author of the book A Fine Mess about our tax system, you're sounding a little like President Trump. It's going to be big. It's going to be a huge deal. Everyone's going to be happy. Everyone's going to be better off. Is this actually doable?
Well, not everybody's going to be happy because people, and particularly corporations, are going to lose some of their cherished deductions. What I'm saying is you can get people to accept it if you offer a simpler return and lower rates. It's worked in other countries. I think everybody would agree that our current tax code is a monster. It's a mess. It's impossible. I asked the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, has anybody in the IRS read the whole tax code? And he laughed at me. Of course not. Who could do that? So I think everybody agrees we've got to make it simpler. And as I said, I think if you take a rifle shot and take out this deduction but leave that deduction, it doesn't work. You got to nail them all. And when you do that and lower the rates, it works. I'm not saying everybody's going to be happy. What I'm saying is other countries have shown that a big reform like that can be done.
What would be the hardest to get rid of deduction or exemption? What's the last to go down?
Well, I take that on in my book. On the individual income tax, the two most popular exemptions, and they're quite expensive, are the mortgage interest deduction and the charitable contribution deduction. Now, can I tell you why we should dump both of them?
Both of them, yeah. I can guess about mortgage. Go on.
The mortgage interest deduction costs the federal government about $103 billion a year. Now, that's money that we could use to treat wounded veterans. I mean, you could build a border wall with it if you wanted. You could reduce the deficit. And instead, it goes as a subsidy to homeowners. And most of the people who take it are in the richest 20% of Americans. So it's for the most part, it's a subsidy to the wealthy. And the argument for it is, well, you know, it encourages homeownership, and that's a good thing. Guess what? That's not the case. Many countries have eliminated the mortgage interest deduction. Britain, Australia, Israel, Germany, Austria, and they have homeownership rates just as high as ours. Several of them have higher homeownership rates than we do. You don't need the mortgage interest deduction to get a homeownership rate of 65%, which is about where we are now.
I can hear the renters cheering right now. And what about their charitable deduction? You don't like that either. Why?
For the same reason, it costs a lot of money. It costs $73 billion a year, which we could use to reduce the deficit or other stuff. And only one-third of taxpayers take the itemized deduction, that is, can take advantage of this deduction. People who put 10 bucks every week in the collection plate at church, people who put 25 bucks in the helmet at the football team's annual dinner, they don't get that deduction because they don't itemize their deductions. And second, we've seen in other countries when they get rid of this, guess what? There's a pattern. You get rid of the charitable deduction for about 1 year. There's a blip down in contributions, and then charity goes right back up with the rate of income growth. People give because they want to help others. People give because they want to support their community. People give, or corporations give, because they want to have their name on the building. The tax deduction, they don't need. And when you take it away, you find that you have the same amount of charitable giving.
You know, we do talk a lot in this country about deductions and loopholes and subsidies. We don't talk as much about what you mentioned, compliance. I have an in-law who bragged about fudging would be a charitable way to put what he does. And that's an American sport.
It is. Yeah. I mean, we had a president who bragged that he didn't pay any tax, although he said he did it legally. And frankly, given the exemptions for the real estate industry in our code, that's possible. He could get away without paying any tax. But here's what I'm thinking. If I'm sitting there slaving over my tax return or paying somebody $300 to do my tax return, and Donald Trump says I never pay taxes, well, then why should I comply? It definitely reduces the impulse for voluntary compliance. And the more complex the thing is, you look at all those exemptions. I don't get them all, but you think, well, those rich guys, they put that in there. So if you could get rid of those, then people are more inclined to think everyone's paying her fair share and I'm going to pay too.
Do you think President Trump ought to be required to release his tax returns?
Well, I don't think anybody, there are countries that make everybody's tax return public. I don't think I'd like to see that in the United States. Would I make an exception for the president? No, I wouldn't make a legal requirement. I'd make a political requirement. I'm not going to vote for you unless you let me see your tax returns. But, you know, that wasn't a bar to his getting elected. No, I don't think I'd make that a legal requirement for any American.
T.R. Reid is the author of the book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax. And we've talked about how other countries do it so much more simple and fair and efficient. What sign do you see, if any, that this is going to happen in our lifetimes, Mr. Reid?
Lifetime. I think it's going to happen pretty quickly, and here's why. You know, Bill, I think history repeats itself. So if you look at the history of the U.S. federal income tax, it started in 1913 and everybody loved it. It was incredibly popular because only the Rockefellers and the Morgans and the Vanderbilts paid it. It was only aimed at the rich. And then gradually, to pay for World War I and stuff, they expanded the tax. In 1922, Congress wrote a big overall tax code, the Internal Revenue Code of 1922. 30 years later, it was a total mess. Guess what? It was full of exemptions and giveaways and credits. And so President Eisenhower demanded that it be redone. They started over. They wrote the Internal Revenue Code of 1954. It was quite simple and worked. And guess what? The lobbyists came in, filled it with exemptions and credits again. 32 years later, in 1986, we did it again. We took away all sorts of loopholes and exemptions and lowered the rate sharply. There's a pattern here. 22, 54, 86, that's every 32 years we have to fix the tax code. Well, guess what? It's been 31 years. The 32-year period is up in 2018. So what I say in my book is we're going to have a new Internal Revenue Code of 2018 because we have to. History demands it. And by looking at how other countries have done it, we can see what we ought to do and what we ought not to do when we rewrite the tax code.
Boy, I sure hear a lot of observers saying, nope, they're going to do one of those temporary expires in 10 years cuts like President Bush did, and they're going to move on to something easier.
Well, that would be tempting. I don't think it would be very popular. And both the president and the Republican leaders in Congress have promised that they're going to do better. Now, do they always do what they promise? I'm afraid not. I just think the timing is right, the impulse is right, and the virtue of this is we know what we should do. We know what works because other countries like us, advanced high-tech democracies, have already done it.
We've been talking with a, do I count you optimistic for major, major tax reform?
Yeah, I'm optimistic that we're going to change. Internal Revenue Code of 2018, we're going to do it.
Okay.
We have to do it.
We must. T.R. Reid, author of the book A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax. T.R. Reid, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Great to be on your air.
Former Washington Post correspondent T.R. Reid. You can hear more from T.R. tonight if you're in Seattle. He'll be speaking at Town Hall at 7:30 p.m. Now, let's think back for a second here. What was your favorite place to hang out in Seattle? All-time favorite. The place where some of your best memories were made. Maybe it was the High Score Arcade or Sit and Spin or the OK Hotel. Why did you love that place so much? And what did you lose when it went away? Those were questions writer and ethnographer Jamie Garbacek wanted to try and answer when she started a project asking for stories about disappearing places in Seattle. It's called Ghosts of Seattle Past. Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
You're the title of the project, the title of the book, Ghosts of Seattle Past, and you might think these are about haunted places in Seattle. There are plenty of ghost stories in this town, but this is about places that no longer exist. Why did you decide to call those places that no longer exist ghosts?
Well, I think that comes down to the inspiration for the book in the first place, which in a lot of respects was the fact that I felt that people were mourning and didn't have a place to put that, didn't have a vehicle or a way to vent or process all of the change. And it did feel as though people were becoming a bit haunted by the places that they missed. And the ghosts for me are people's memories more than they are the places that are gone. But you can also say that the haunts, in air quotes, you know, the places that we all haunted, the gathering places that we spent time becoming the best versions of ourselves in, and the places that shaped the city and that shaped different communities, those haunts are our ghosts as well.
Well, initially, the project you had in mind was smaller in scope than what it is now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a website, but it was also going to be an art exhibit and a zine. Mm-hmm. But what happened? What caused the scope of it to change?
The response to the call for submissions. We just had an avalanche, a veritable avalanche of stories come in. I mean, there were hundreds, and the parameters were really simple. The place had to be public. It had to be gone, and you had to have a personal memory of the space. It couldn't be like a historical thing that you felt was significant, you had to have had the memory yourself. It exploded.
It exploded. You described the number of submissions you got as an avalanche. You put your hand over your heart as you were describing all of the submissions you got. What's a story that comes to mind that you got that you would have never expected to get?
Okay. Yeah, I've got one for you. So Janet Schurel sent me a note about her brother, Fritz, who had drowned in a bog in West Seattle when he was a kid, when they were very young. And I was confused at first about how this was a lost place for her. I mean, it was clearly a very compelling and very sad story, but I wasn't sure what she meant for me to be marking or preserving as the space that had been lost. And what it turned out that that bog had been a gardening space for a lot of Japanese families that produced food for Pike Place Market. But during the internment, they all were taken. And when they were, that arable land became a bog and children drowned in it. Yeah. I had never heard anything about that before. There's been very little reportage on it, honestly. But what that did for me was to completely resituate the way I thought about our interconnectivity in the city, because when we think about the internment, it's clearly a specifically a tragedy for the Japanese community and for the international community. But it's not, you know? I mean, their disappearance has a profound effect on everyone around them as well. And I guess I just felt like that story really made a very visual metaphor of the way that we are never on our own in a city. We're never isolated. We're never able to escape and shouldn't try to escape the way that we are codependent and that we are reliant on everyone around us to make a safe and vibrant landscape. And those sorts of tragedies have ripple effects you'd never see coming.
That's an amazing story. I'm talking with Jamie Garbacek. She's the creator of the anthology Ghosts of Seattle Past. It's also an interactive art exhibit. And I have to say, though, it feels like when we talk about change, particularly in Seattle, where it happens so rapidly, we always assume that there's loss, that there's heartbreak associated with it. I mean, I looked at three news stories yesterday about change and development in Seattle, and I'll read you the headlines. Two are from the Seattle Times. Upzoning has some Belltown residents worried. Mm-hmm. Row House Cafe, a South Lake Union holdout to be torn down for apartments. And then a third one from Crosscut. Poor gargoyles. We're smashing Seattle's history as we build. I mean, does change always have to bring this sense of loss?
I think change is inevitable and often good and healthy. I'm pro-density. I think there's an easy assumption to make that this is some kind of NIMBY project. And the truth is, it couldn't be further from that. I mean, I am from the East Coast and I'm used to dense cities. And I think that that can be a really healthy environment for thriving art and diversity. The difference is the way that we're developing here and the rapidity of it and whether or not that process is inclusive. And so, yes, I do think that there's always going to be loss, but I don't think that that needs to have the collateral damage of so much forgetting. There hasn't been as much effort to preserve culturally significant spaces here in some respects as many other cities. And again, I'm not anti-development, but I want to see it be an inclusive process that has demographically diverse conversations involved. I don't want as much cultural erasure as has been prevalent in Seattle's history. I mean, we have a very long history of erasing what came before in order to capitalize on innovation in the moment. And I think that if we want to be this world-class city that we all sit around dreaming about, that to do that, it needs to be an inclusive process, and we need to be really cautious that we don't price out all artists and people of color and queer people, because it's going to become a really homogenous, very white, very rich city with a lot less to recommend it if we are not more careful about that.
It does make me wonder, though, the portrait you are painting of Seattle's future doesn't sound very exciting, and it doesn't sound very welcoming. Do you have any optimism for Seattle's future?
I'll be honest, I'm definitely afraid for Seattle right now. San Francisco's dead. It's over. It's still a beautiful city, but it doesn't have the same heartbeat that it had 20 years ago. And I don't want to see that happen here. I don't think that it's inevitable. But I think that there's a real danger of it becoming frighteningly the same, you know, a very repetitious landscape. And I don't mean just condos. I mean the kind of people who can afford to be here and the kind of businesses and projects that can afford to be here, the kind of art that can afford to thrive here. And so I think it's possible that it can continue to be wonderful, but I think we're at a really dangerous tipping point right now where it could kind of go either way. And what I wanted for this project was two things, was for people to have a way to process this change in grief and to commemorate the places that they loved, and for that to, you know, to be something that people can hold in their hands and to give it back to them. And at the same time, it was to hopefully inform the city and developers and city officials and people who are making some of the choices about what is going to happen in the city going forward, about what mattered most and what was most significant to people at a certain moment in time.
So beyond remembering what places that are gone might have meant to me, what would you have me do? How can we contribute to this vision that you're talking about for what Seattle could be?
Show up. Show up to your community's events and picnics and theater productions. Not everyone can show up to like a city planning meeting. You know, you might not have childcare. You might be working three jobs. Like, there's a barrier to entry to being involved in the process of being part of the planning. But you can help to make sure that more diverse voices are heard if you are in dialogue with your neighbors. You know, when we were gathering stories, a lot of it wasn't just what came into us. You know, I was going out and interviewing people, but we were going to, say, like the Roots family picnic at Gasworks. You know, we would show up to that because I lived in the Central District and I knew a lot of the people there, and we would ask them about places they miss, and some of the things that would come up isn't necessarily what you'd anticipate. I mean, I expect to hear about the old jazz venues that are gone, but I didn't expect to hear about the lack of a specific hardware store that had been a very important cultural service, in the sense that the owner would go right to people's houses and help them make repairs, and they had specialized knowledge, and they were willing to give things on credit to people they knew. And that was a huge leg up for a lot of families in economic distress. These sorts of things weren't even on, I mean, if I'm honest, weren't even on my radar as being the biggest concerns. But once you start showing up for your community in that way, once you know that, it's so much easier to make sure that there is representation and to make sure that there concerns are included in the decision making of the city. You know, don't live in your little bubble in this city in the future. get outside your comfort zone and interact with as many people as are in this city, or else pretty soon it's just going to be you and people just like you here.
That's Jamie Garbacek, creator of Ghosts of Seattle Past. The book is out today. There are readings tonight at Elliott Bay Books and The Rendezvous. Next up, what a UW researcher learned when she tried to figure out where fake news about mass shootings and terrorist attacks come from. That's coming up on The Record. Hi, you're with The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel. Earlier this hour, we talked about the video of the United Express passenger being dragged off an airplane by security. Now, the CEO of United has issued an apology. The Associated Press reports, United CEO Oscar Munoz says, quote, "No one should ever be treated this way." He says United will fix what's broken so this never happens again. He's promising to review United's policies for asking people to give up their seats, how they'll handle oversold flights, and how the airline will work with airport authorities and local law enforcement. He says he'll get back to everybody with what he finds out by the end of this month. That news from the Associated Press. Mainstream news, not fake news. Except not everyone these days believes mainstream media is telling the truth in its news coverage. This skepticism is particularly noticeable in the days after a terrorist attack or mass shooting. That's when rumors start to spread on social media. Speculation about what really happened, who's really responsible. When University of Washington professor Kate Starbird began to study all those rumors, she noticed a pattern. One rumor kept popping up again and again, what she calls false flag rumors, conspiracy theories suggesting the government, the mainstream media, they're lying about what really happened and who really did it. Starbird was curious about that pattern, so she followed tweets sent out after an attack and she mapped them to see where else those false flag stories showed up on the internet. And what she found
kind of blew my mind, because I went in with this set of expectations of what was going on there, and it was not at all what I ended up finding. You know, I thought this was sort of marginal. I thought this was a few people, maybe conspiracy theorists who are just, you know, our stereotype that these people are mentally ill and they go there and they hear these things. And I also went in thinking, you know, we're going to see a sort of a typical U.S. right versus U.S. left kind of political conversations going on here. Not at all. It was something completely different.
What was it?
The predominant theme across all of these websites is something that is called anti-globalism. And they use that term precisely. They also talk about anti-corporatism. They talk about anti-media, anti-mainstream media. They are propagating theories. Some of them are explicit and some of them more implicit, sort of echoes of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about rich, powerful bankers who rule the world, or rich, powerful people who rule the world in ways that we can't perceive, who orchestrate world events and pull strings, whether they're U.S. government actors or other kinds of actors that are outside of government. There's also a lot of sort of anti-West, anti-European Union, anti-sort of American power in the world. And then a host of other sort of pseudoscience type things, anti-science, anti-vaccine, anti-GMO, and they were all of these things were present across so many of these different sites. So none of these sites just did one conspiracy theory. They had all of these conspiracy theories, and they didn't necessarily put together like a cohesive worldview. They actually put together, I mean, if you assembled it all, you know, there's that anti-globalism versus nationalism spectrum, which was the salient political dimension. But there are other things that just didn't all fit together. And then it took me a while to figure out what those were.
Well, I'm hearing you use some of these words, anti-globalism, anti-imperialism, even anti-GMO. And I'm sure that we have listeners who are thinking, that doesn't necessarily sound so bad to sort of, you know, to prod at those structures.
Absolutely.
And see what, you know, and see what's happening there. So what is the overall picture here? I'm trying to get a sense of what this means.
Yeah, let me explain a little bit. So what globalism is a term that people can use to bring a lot of people in. A lot of people have criticisms about globalism of different kinds. Like for some people, that means the sort of neoliberal free trade practices or whatever that have impacts in different ways on people around the world. But for some people, anti-globalism means anti-immigration. They want borders closed. And what it serves is as sort of a magnet to bring people from different sides of the political spectrum into what is a becomes a nationalist ideology. So what happens is it becomes explicit on some of the websites I saw and not as explicit on others, but they're all connected. So the same people are going there. But in some, they're like, the opposite of globalism is nationalism. And we know nationalism as an ideology is spreading all over the world. And there's an intersection here, or at least that's what I saw in these alternative media spaces, of an intersection of these anti-globalist worldviews that are being sort of shaped and crafted and that appeal to many of us. And they don't just appeal to people on the right. There's also sort of alternative left-leaning sites in this space as well. And they're connected. And a lot of the issues that are promoted on these sites are ones that appeal to people on the right and left. And I'll give you an example. So I take it out of the academic paper. I publish that. I get reviews. They say it's valid. So I take that and I write a public-facing blog that people can see and hopefully be accessible. And people comment on it. And I interact with people on Facebook and other places on it. I interact with a person who's bought in and bought in by, we were we're conversing about the flat earth theory. He's bought in now to the flat earth theory. He believes that the earth is just as likely flat as round and we've been lied to about the moon landing and everything else. But I want to tell you how he got there because I asked him, how did you get here? And he said, well, first it was like I had this really concern about GMOs. And so I went online, I was looking at them and I ended up on an Alex Jones website. And he has this whole thing about exposing GMOs and how this corporation is trying to manipulate the world in different ways for their power structure.
And if Alex Jones, that name is familiar, Alex Jones runs the website InfoWars, which is in many ways an alt-right kind of conspiracy theory site. But also President Donald Trump has more than once referenced articles that he's found on InfoWars as well.
Yes. And this is where these things start intersecting with world political events. So this person went from GMOs, goes on to Alex Jones's site, now is a 9/11 truther, doesn't quite know whether to believe whether the world is round anymore, and is buying nutritional supplements in bulk from Alex Jones, right? And then I was like, okay, that's data point one. I did notice that all these sites were selling nutritional supplements. I thought it was odd. I didn't write about it, but I did, like, that was one of the things I coded for. So it's coded across all my data. I've marked each site and what they were selling and what their ads were. Then I start looking deeper on some of the people and these intersections, like there's a lot of people that are coming from the left. When I look at their tweet history, they're coming from the left through GMOs into the alt-right, they become Trump supporters and they're buying and selling and advertising nutritional supplements. Now, I don't know how to encapsulate all of what's going on there, but there are a lot of things at work, and what we thought was this very marginal behavior is like intersecting with political power on a global scale. It's fascinating and somewhat disturbing. I can see your face. You look a little disturbed.
I'm surprised.
I've been disturbed for several months, and I was very surprised as well.
Who is propagating these rumors? I mean, we've been talking about the recipients and the people who pass them along, but where is this originating?
I think it's going to be hard to work out these different groups, but I can kind of talk about three different groups. And one is there's true believers who've got a blog or something. They believe these things. They've got this way of conspiratorial thinking, and that's how they see the world, and they're propagating it. Then there's a group of people that are maybe the Alex Joneses of the world. Maybe he's a true believer, or maybe he's a half believer, but they've recognized that they can make money on this. And so they're propagating these ideas. Some of these websites that I saw were just clearing houses for all sorts of conspiracy theories, and they're selling their nutritional supplements. And so I think that they're trying to leverage this, you know, for a monetary reason or a political reason, but they're sort of individual actors. But there's also footprints of a purposeful disinformation campaign. And I had a hunch they would be there, but within my data set are RT, which is the Russia Today or Russia Times. We have Sputnik News. We have a site called Katehan, which is a think tank of Russian and Eastern Ukrainians. And we have all of these accusations that there are purposeful information trajectories where Russian news outlets are trying to get these stories into these other information spaces. And for us in the U.S., we're like, holy moly, what? But when I start reading and interacting with folks who have lived in former Soviet states in that area of the world, they're used to this. They're like, of course that's happening. That's been happening to us for, in some ways, for generations, but certainly, you know, for the last 5 or 10 years, there's the current Russian government, the Putin government, has a tactic of hybrid war where they use purposeful disinformation. The strategy is not to necessarily convince you of anything. The strategy is to have you start distrusting information. So they just put as many different things out there in the world to confuse people and to undermine your trust in information. And if you can think about a world, an end state for that, when mainstream news becomes fake news, and that is a refrain that's being shared across a large, not just the conspiracy theorist, this is being shared across, you know, 20, 30, 40% of our population right now. That's the end goal state of disinformation. I learned this after, which helped me explain what was happening in my data, because I showed it to people who had some experience on Russian studies and Russian scholars. And they're like, oh, you need to read this paper. You need to read this article. You need to go watch this documentary. And they've already known this was happening. We just didn't know what was happening to us. So I think that's the third piece. There's these three different pieces of what's going on in this information space. And it's hard to work out which pieces are which sometimes.
What do you see as the next step?
As a researcher and sort of a technology person, so my work intersects with, you know, my students go off and work at Facebook and Twitter and places like that. I think it's a kind of an all hands on deck type moment for those of us who care. And I don't think we need to talk about right or left politics. I think we need to talk about something much more profound to think about what are the solutions to a disinformation ecosystem. That is being supported by some of the tools and systems we have. Some of the reasons this works is that we have social media that connect people where it's hard to know who is who and how information flows that way. And we've got to figure out what's going on very quickly. And I can't tell you, like, what do we do? What do we do when a person's sunk in? I have no idea. When you're believing the flat Earth theory, I don't know what we can do once you're already there. Maybe we can find ways of scaffolding a progress out of that kind of way of thinking. I'm hoping there's a way to make folks that aren't already there a little more resilient to going there. The biggest problem isn't that. The biggest problem is the large portion of the society right now who doesn't believe anything, who's starting to be skeptical of everything. The goal of disinformation, their stated goal is once you're skeptical of everything, you don't trust information, then you're very easily manipulated. So we're getting to a point where all of us are skeptical of everything we see because we don't know who to trust, because there's been this purposeful erosion. I mean, people have purposefully been eroding our trust in information, and there's rhetoric around it. And then the information system and how information spreads is supporting that. I think it's really dangerous, and I don't know what to do.
If you were to tell someone else how they should evaluate the information that they're taking in, because, I mean, we're bombarded with it.
Yeah.
I can't not go somewhere without having some, I mean, I can't pump gas in my car without having a screen throw information at me at this point. So how do we evaluate it?
Once I figured this out, I thought, this is a long shot, but maybe I can help people just by telling them what's going on. And so what I've been trying to do is sort of inoculate people against some of these things just by letting people know that it's out there, right? So I wrote a blog that people could access to say, hey, there's these theories out there. You've probably seen them. They're connected to these other kinds of things. They appeal both to people on the right. Maybe you don't like people on the right. You don't think of yourselves as being on the right, but they appeal to people on the left too. Oh, that makes you uncomfortable. So I'm trying to communicate this into a way that people can see what's going on. And maybe if they think about what's going on before they confront the information, they might react differently to it when they see it. And I did the same with this most recent event around this horrible attacks, the gas attacks in Syria.
Yeah.
And I wrote this post. I said, I just heard about this. I'm going to let you know within hours or days, people are going to be talking about how this is a hoax event or a false flag event that wasn't done by the Syrian government, that was done by the U.S. government in some way, or was staged so for some other reason. And just to let you know, that's going to happen. And they're going to find evidence to fit that theory, but they're going to say that every time. So just to know that's out, and you can choose whether or not you believe it, but just to let you know that that's what's going to happen.
What's your next question with this research?
We have a lot of questions. I think we want to distinguish between, like, these different kinds of things, these emergent actors that are just trying to make money versus like, where do we actually have state Russia purposeful disinformation tactics and try to distinguish between the two? I think it would be important for like telling the story. I think if we can reveal to people that their information is coming from a purposeful disinformation strategy from a foreign state, I think that they may think about things differently. And that's the second thing. I want to work on solutions. What are possible solutions? How can we save one person from going into this space, or how can we help the larger portion of us from falling victim to sort of this skepticism and information that I think is going to be very detrimental to our country and our world?
Kate Starbird is an assistant professor in the Department of Human-Centered Design and Engineering at the University of Washington. And she and I talked about false flag events, how that's presented on social media. She said that in a blog post, she told people that after the awful chemical attacks in Syria, they should be watching for those stories, those false flag stories about the Syrian chemical attacks. One of the headlines on the website InfoWars today is that the Syrian chemical attack was a false flag event and that Russian President Vladimir Putin suggests we wait for more. We tweeted out a link to Kate Starbird's blog where she talks about how to arm yourself against falling for fake news. You can find that link at KUOW. That's The Record for Tuesday afternoon. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.